From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the mid-1930s, a group of unemployed writers were hired by the Depression-era Works Progress Administration, the WPA, to go south, find as many of the 100,000 free slaves still living as they could, and interview them about their lives before freedom. They went armed with tape recorders and a list of questions and came back with an astonishing record of slavery in America as told by one-time slaves in their own words. Stories of plantation life and relationships, of meals and marriage, of brutality and defiance and sometimes transcendence. Thousands of former slaves were interviewed and their voices preserved in the Library of Congress. This month, HBO has come out with a new documentary highlighting the testimonials of American slaves. It's called Unchained Memories, Readings from the Slave Narratives.
Of course we know it was wrong to steal, but the niggas had to steal to get something to eat. I know I did. I got so hungry I steal chickens off their roost. Yes'm, I did. Chickens used to roost on the fence stand right out in the night. We'd cook the chicken at night, eat him, and burn the feathers.
When a slave die, massa make the coffin and send a couple of niggas to bury the body and say, don't be long, and no singing or praying allowed. Put them in the ground. Cover them up. Hurry on back to that field.
A cold and frosty morning. The niggas mighty good. Take your axe upon your shoulder, nigga. Talk to the bud.
This time tomorrow night.
Sometimes they sing this sorrowful because some niggas have been beat or whipped or sold away.
White folks sure would whip you in them days. They lay you flat on the ground on your face. Then they stake you. And so you couldn't get through the ground, much less than get up and fly. Take every rag off of you and leave you plumb naked, and then they whip you till the blood come. They whip you straight like this, see? Straight up and down, and then they checker you. In other words, they beat you crosswise, and so your flesh would cut up in squares. You understand?
William Wells Brown, one of the most famous fugitive slaves, once argued that slavery can never be represented. But we are trying to at least gain a deeper understanding of the American slave experience. I hope you'll listen tonight and ask yourself what you hear. Suffering? Strength? Victims or survivors? And how does our race today color the way we, as individuals, hear the voices of one-time American slaves? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tonight we're joined from New York City by Jacqueline Glover, producer of the HBO documentary Unchained Memories. Good evening and welcome, Jacqueline Glover.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To be here.
It's great to have you. Thank you for being with us. From Cincinnati, we're joined by Dr. Cynthia Goodman, guest curator of the Unchained Memories exhibit at the Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Goodman.
Good evening. It's also nice to join you.
Thanks for joining us. And from College Park, Maryland tonight, we're joined by Ira Berlin, professor of history at the University of Maryland, an advisor to Unchained Memories, chief advisor, and editor of Remembering Slavery, African Americans Talk About Their Personal Experiences of Slavery and Emancipation, from which we'll be hearing excerpts tonight. Good evening and welcome, Ira Berlin.
Good evening, and good evening to Jackie and Cynthia.
I want to thank you all for joining us, and I guess we should thank HBO for putting the documentary up. Documentaries are not made all over the place today, and certainly not given that kind of exposure. Jacqueline Glover, I want to start with you and ask. Mm-hmm. I guess this is playing repeatedly through this month. It's already been on. What are viewers and listeners, as they listen, responding to in Unchained Memories, in the images and most of all the words and voices of one-time slaves? What are they surprised by? What are they responding to?
Well, I certainly think that they are responding. You know, we do have actors in this film that you see on camera, and I think that seeing the actors on camera really gives you a more human feeling for these people.
Help us put a face on that. Who are some of the actors who are voicing
we've
these?
We've got Samuel Jackson, mm-hmm. Angela Bassett, mm-hmm. CCH Pounder, Alfre Woodard, Vanessa Williams, Oprah Winfrey, mm-hmm. Don Cheadle. We have
so faces and voices that people know, but they're mm-hmm. but they're bringing a message that people may not ever have heard.
Right. I think it's also just being able to see an individual, getting to sense a person. I think a lot of people, have some sense of what slavery is, but are not taught or think about it in terms of individuals. And I think that this documentary and I think that the actors truly help bringing that sense. And also, of course, the words that these are actually the mm-hmm. words of former slaves. And you really get to appreciate and understand them as individuals and as people who had endured slavery.
Cynthia Goodman, in Cincinnati at the Underground Railroad Freedom Center, you see people every day, I guess, who are coming through and absorbing that time, that culture, those experiences, and yet here are the actual words, and we'll hear tonight, the actual voices of one-time slaves. What strikes people when they gain for the first time that intimacy with the slavery experience of the voice in their ear, the very words of people who were slaves?
I think what really is so extraordinary, and I think we all have to congratulate Jacqueline Glover for this remarkable film, we've all thought about slavery with a capital F, and what these potent narratives do is they give names and faces to the institution, and there really is an unprecedented degree of realism so that we're able to associate these remarkable stories of suffering and endurance and courage to a specific former slave.
Mm-hmm. So the voice is right there. I guess on that very point, Ira Berlin, it brings up something I wanted to put to you, this issue of realism. In the HBO documentary, big name actors, actresses, personalities are on board to read these narratives, and more than read them. You are very familiar with the actual tape recordings of the actual one-time slaves made in the 1930s. When you listen to the voices of those who had been slaves and those reading these lines all these decades later, is this realism? Is there a 21st century gloss that's put on here? Are the narrators picking up the real, genuine tenor that you hear in the actual recordings?
Well, these are some extraordinary people who are reading them, and they are giving them a deep resonance. I think
an authentic resonance.
Well, authentic, of course, takes on many, 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 many different meanings. Mm-hmm. I think it has a kind of immediacy, which creates a kind of authenticity, which I think that's exactly what we try to achieve. Jackie tried to achieve in Unchained Memories, and yes, I do think there's a kind of up close and mm-hmm. up close and personal sense that we get from Unchained. Unchained Memories, a kind of bringing home that, after all, most of us think of slavery as an anachronistic institution, an institution of the distant past.
Yes.
And suddenly we realize that it, with two or three generational jumps, we can meet and experience and know something about people who experience slavery directly.
It is not
that kind of connection.
It is not so very, very long ago. Ira Berlin, I want to, above all tonight, hear those voices, and we're lucky to have them from the WPA recordings, actual voices of American one-time slaves. I'd like to dive in and begin to hear them, and then get the response of all three of you, if we could. And let's start off with the voice here of a former slave named Fountain Hughes. He claimed to be 101 years old when he was recorded in 1949. Could that be?
That's right.
His great-great-grandfather worked for Thomas Jefferson. He talks here about, well, you'll hear it, slave life being something like life in jail. Let's listen to the voice of one-time slave Fountain Hughes.
My grandfather belonged to Thomas Jefferson. My grandfather was 115 years old when he died. And now I am 101 years old.
You talk about how old you are, Uncle Fountain. How far back do you remember?
Well, I tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in my boy days, The boys live quite different from where they live now. Oh, you wore dress like a woman till I was probably 10, 12, 13 years old.
So you wore a dress, Phil?
Yes, I didn't wear no pants, and of course I didn't make boys' pants. Boys wore dresses. It was just the same as we were in jail. Now, I couldn't go from here across the street. Well, I couldn't go to nobody's house without I have a note or something from my master. And if I had that pass, that was what we call a pass. If I had that pass, I could go wherever he sent me, and I'd have to be back, you know, when I, whoever he sent me to. They'd give me another pass, and I'd bring that back, so it's to show how long I'd been gone. We couldn't go out and stay an hour or 2 hours or something like that. But I couldn't just walk away like the people does now, you know. It's what they call, we were slaves. We belonged to people.
Former slave Fountain Hughes, recorded in 1949, could not cross the street without a pass from his master. Ira Boleyn, could you paint a picture for us of how these recordings took place? We hear the interviewer's voice there. We hear Fountain Hughes. How were these interviewees found out? Where did people sit down with them? What was the setting?
Well, we don't know a lot about that. The settings were many. They were numerous. The interviews were done, the recorded interviews were done by a very, very small number of people who are using this new equipment that probably fits more snugly in the back of a pickup truck than it does our contemporary recording equipment, which fits, you know, in tiny little places. It's a project that begins in the early 1930s and is continued here. Most of the interviews are transcribed in various ways, often from a set of prepared questions, but many interviewers freelanced, went off on their own. It makes the transcribed interviews in some ways very problematic documents, and of course gives very great weight to those few recorded interviews where we have the voices of the people themselves.
The transcript's problematic because they could be doctored, enhanced, toyed with.
Exactly, that they were done by people who had no particular skills in transcribing and no particular interest in learning a shorthand, who sometimes did them that night when they got home, but might have been tired and did them the next day.
But here we have the tape. Jacqueline Glover, if I may ask you, you're an HBO producer. You're attuned to tone. When you dug in and listened to these tapes, what did you hear? Resentment, acceptance, seething anger, people at peace? Can you even generalize?
Hard to generalize. I mean, I think everyone had their own individual response to the questions. But for the most part, I think they were just telling what their lives were like, that without any judgment attached. I mean, they knew that they should not have been slaves, I think, for the most part. I got that sense from reading the transcripts.
Did you hear black people speaking to white interviewers toning it down or not?
It varied. I think it depended on the person. Mm-hmm. And I know certainly for the documentary, the narratives that I did end up choosing for the film, clearly they had no problem telling the interviewer whether they were white or black what their situation was, and were pretty straightforward with what their treatment was. Certainly there were narratives that I had come across that seemed to say, well, you know, nothing happened on our plantation, but let me tell you about the plantation down the road.
That old story.
That seemed to be something that happened a lot. But I really looked at the narratives that seemed to just come from people who were very forthright and were going to say what their life was like without feeling, you know, scared to do that.
We got it. We are talking tonight with Jacqueline Glover, HBO producer, Dr. Cynthia Goodman from the Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati, Ohio, and Ira Boleyn, who's joining us tonight from College Park, Maryland. We're listening to the voices of American slaves, getting the story of African-American slaves in their own words. What do we hear? when American slaves tell their own story. We'll be right back. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're listening tonight to the voices of American slaves. And what do we hear when American slaves tell their own story in their own words, in their own voices? Do we tend to block out the details of slavery to keep slavery flat and distant? What do we hear in these voices that we don't read in our history books? Do you hear strength here? Do you hear suffering? Do you hear both? My guests tonight are Jacqueline Glover. She's producer of the HBO documentary Unchained Memories, Readings from the Slave Narratives. From Cincinnati, Ohio tonight, Dr. Cynthia Goodman, a guest curator on that documentary and organizer of an exhibit at the Underground Railroad Freedom Center, and professor of history at the University of Maryland, Ira Berlin, who is also editor of Remembering Slavery, African Americans Talk About Their Personal Experiences of Slavery and Emancipation. I want to ask the indulgence of all three of our guests now to take a few minutes with us and listen to the voices of slaves, which are, after all, the most important, so we can get more of that out on the table for you to comment on, for our listeners to hear. I want to turn first to a piece of tape from a one-time slave named Laura Smalley, talking about one of the worst beatings she ever saw.
Well, they take that old woman, poor old woman, cat in the peach orchard, and whipped her. And, you know, just tied her hand this way, you know, around the peach orchard tree. I remember that just as well, looked like to me I can, and round a tree and whipped her. And well, she couldn't do nothing but just kick her feet, you know, just kick her feet. But it just had her clothes off down to her waist, you know. Just didn't have her plumb naked, but they had her clothes down to her waist. And every now and then they'd whip her, you know, and then snuff the pipe out on her, you know. She'd snuff pipe out on her. You know, the embers in the pipe, and where you'll see the pipe smoking.
Blow them out on her?
Mm-hmm.
Good Lord, mercy.
Blew out on her.
Did she scream?
Yeah, I reckon she was. I reckon she did.
The voice of one-time slave Laura Smalley talking about a whooping, in her words, in the peach orchard. Ira Berlin, help us understand exactly what we've heard here. First of all, did I hear her say that this, it sounded like a slave, well, herself, a slave woman was beaten by another woman? Or was whipped by another woman?
Well, certainly that, you know, that happened. But I think the question that you ask, you know, what exactly does it mean? What are these former slaves trying to tell us about slavery? Mm-hmm. And I think that's central to Unchained Memories, and I think it's central to what we try to do in remembering slavery. And I think there are two things that they're trying to tell us. One of the things they're trying to tell us is Laura Smalley is trying to tell us is that slavery was an extraordinarily violent institution.
And cruel. She describes
cruel
the person and having embers blown onto their whipped back.
Of course, when you give people that kind of power, there are some people who are sadists, and you heard that in this particular instance. And I think that's certainly one of the stories that we hear in Unchained Memories. But there's another story, and it's an equally important story, and it's another story which I think the former slaves want to tell us. And that, of course, is that they didn't give in to that inhumanity and violence, that they created life, that they had families, that they had religion, that they had certain standards that they met. We have a wonderful take in Unchained Memories, this one read by CCH Pounder, where she explains how slaves danced and how they didn't dance the way we dance today in the 20th century, that is up close, physical, mm-hmm. touching. Mm-hmm. But they had standards, this particular former slave wanted everybody to know that their standards were not the standards that were placed on them by their owners, but they were standards created within the slave community. Mm.
So there's always this tension in depicting this time between the damage and the resistance, the suffering and the survival, or the standards, as you say.
That's exactly correct, and it's that tension, those two stories, which I think Unchained Memory captures with extraordinary poignancy.
We want to hear more words of slaves, this time actually read by James Earl Jones here, but reading the words of 87-year-old Robert Glenn on the first-hand experience of being put on the block and sold.
Later in the day, he put me on the block and named another price, much higher than the price formerly set. He was asked by the white folks to name his price for his bargain, and he did so. I was again put on the auction block, and Father bought me in, putting up the cash. Long Ben flew into a rage, saying, "You think you are white, do you? Now, just to show you are black, I will not let you have your son at any price." Father knew it was all off. Mother was frantic, but there was nothing they could do about it. They had to stand and see the speculator put me on his horse behind him and ride away without allowing either of them to tell me goodbye. I figure I was sold 3 times in one day. Mother was told, on the threat of whooping, not to make any outcry when I was carried away. He took me to his home, but on the way he stopped for refreshments at a plantation, and while he was eating and drinking, he put me into a room where 2 white women were spinning flax. I was given a seat across the room from where they were working. After I had sat there a while, wondering where I was going and thinking about mother and home, I went over to one of the women and asked, "Missus, when will I see my mother again?" She replied, "I don't know, child. Go and sit down."
James Earl Jones, reading the words of 87-year-old Robert Glenn, one-time slave, there describing his own sale. Cynthia Goodman, if I may ask you, in your experience with these transcripts, with these voices, was the moment of sale the ultimate moment, that moment of separation, that moment of powerlessness over fate? Does it emerge as the kind of cosmically awful moment here?
Well, in some of the narratives, that is indeed the case. Of course, the moment of sale is not included in all the narratives, and mm-hmm. in others, that moment, the really utterly transcendent moment, is the moment at which the former slave decides against all odds, with the specter again of potential not only separation from their family,
yes.
but the specter that their whole family might be punished for their act of resistance. But that is the moment when they decide to run away.
To hit the road, despite all the risks, that must have been a giddy, terrifying leap.
For them, their family, and of course, if they were caught, frequently dogs were sent after them, mm-hmm. paddy rollers went after them, and upon their return, the severity of their punishment was such that it often did result in death.
But here, as we heard James Earl Jones reading, Robert Glenn describing how his mother warned him to make no outcry as he was carried away to who knows where. I want to hear more voices and let our listeners hear. Here's former slave Harriet Smith being interviewed about going to church where there would be services for whites during the day and blacks at night. Harriet Smith.
Sunday in the evening, the white folks let the preacher preach. That I was for the day church preaching.
Well, did you go to the white folks' church any?
Yes, I went to Mountain City to the white folks' church many times. See, the white folks would have church in the morning, then they'd let the colored people have church at their church in the evening.
During slavery?
During slave time, yes. Huh. Slave time.
Well, would the white preachers tell you to behave yourselves and be...
Oh, yes,
be good to your masters?
Yes, that's what they preach.
The white preachers telling slaves, and there in the voice of one former slave, Harriet Smith, to obey the white master. Jacqueline Glover, I keep coming back to this question, but I wonder at the bitterness level. This was many decades mm-hmm. after the mm-hmm. experience of slavery. Mm-hmm. Does the bitterness come across as present and real, or is it packaged and boxed and put in the past by former slaves?
Well, it's interesting because I think it really varies on the person. I know we have one narrative in the film by a man named James Maddox. Mm-hmm. And he talks about hating the white man for what was done to him. Clearly, he's very bitter. But other people, and even I think if you know, just having heard the woman who just spoke, she's explaining and describing what happened, but I don't hear the bitterness in it.
That's what struck me. There's a kind of yep. an even tone as she conveys
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really just them explaining their lives, telling a story about their lives. I think most of them also were probably pretty grateful to be able to put it on record and mm-hmm. to be able to explain what happened. I wonder whether they'd been asked before, you know, to really talk about what happened to them.
There's a kind of power and justice just in getting the words recorded.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. I think probably many of them were grateful for being able to put it on record. Mm.
Cynthia Goodman described before the transcendent moment often coming when people left slavery, ran from slavery, ran to freedom. I want to listen here to the words of former slave Mary Barber, read by Debbie Allen, about her father running, I understand, to join the Union Army.
One of the first things that I remember was my pappy waking me up in the middle of the night, dressing me in the dark, all the time telling me to keep quiet, quiet. One of the twins hollered some, and Pat put his hand over his mouth to keep it quiet. And after he was dressed, he went outside and peeped around for a minute. Then he came back and got us. And we even sneaked out the house and along the wood path. Pappy toting one of the twins and holding me by the hand, and Mammy carrying the other two. I reckon I will always remember that walk, with the bushes slapping my legs and the wind seemed to be just sighing in the trees and the hoot owls and the whippoorwills hollering at each other from the big trees. I was half asleep, but I sure was scared. Ooh, scared. But in a little while, we passed a plum thicket, and there was the mules in the wagon. There was the quilt at the bottom of the wagon, and on this, they lays us youngins, and Pappy and Mammy gets on the board across the front and drives off down that road. Oh, I sure was sleepy. I sure was scared, too. And we rides along. I listens to Pappy and Mammy talk. And Pappy's telling Mammy about the Yankees coming to their plantation, burning the corn cribs and smokehouse and just tearing up, destroying everything. He says right low that they done took Master Jordan down in Norfolk, and that he stole the mules and the wagon and escaped. Ooh, we was scared of them Yankees to start with, but the more we thinks about running away from our masters, the scarier we gets of them Rebs. Anyhow, Pappy say that we is going to join the Yankees.
There, the words of former slave Mary Barber, read by Debbie Allen. Ira Berlin, I want to be sure I depict what's going on here correctly. Clearly, it's during the Civil War. The Yankees have come through. The plantation is upset, maybe destroyed. The plantation owner may be dethroned and gone. And this is a slave family that was taking off. Is that right?
That's exactly correct. And I think one of the questions you asked before about authenticity is that here we have a variety of opinions given to us, reminiscences of people who are old, poor, often speaking to white interviewers in the middle of the Depression. But one of the subjects about which memory is extraordinarily clear and direct, of course, is the moment of emancipation. Everybody remembers how they got free.
In incredible detail, she recalls the bushes slapping her legs as they walked in the night, and the quilt and the wagon where she lay down.
Here are people who have been enslaved, treated as property, as things, for over 300 years, suddenly emerging as free people in a very, very dangerous circumstance, a circumstance where capture could easily mean death, certainly division of families, certainly a violent beating. This is not something that you forget easily.
I'm fascinated in reading and listening to these by the social structure of the slave community itself. I want to hear some tape here from former slave Caroline Johnson Harris, read by Esther Rowley, describing slave marriage.
Didn't have to ask Master or nothing. Just go to Aunt Sue and tell her you wants to get mated. She tell us to think about it hard for 2 days, 'cause marrying was sacred in the eyes of Jesus. After 2 days, Mose and I went back and say we done thought about it and we still want to get married. Then she called all the slaves after task to pray for the union that God was going to make. Pray we stay together and have lots of children and none of them get sold away from the parents. Then she lay a broomstick across the sill of the house we was going to live in and join our hands together. Before we step over it, she asked us once more if we were sure we wanted to get married. Of course we said yes. Then she said, in the eyes of Jesus, step into the holy land of matrimony. When we stepped across the broomstick, we was married. It was bad luck to touch the broomstick. Folks always stepped high because they didn't want no spell cast on them. Aunt Sue used to say whichever one touched the stick was going to die first.
The words of former slave Caroline Johnson Harris. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Cynthia Goodman, I want to ask you there. Marriage is being described, I guess, a wedding ceremony, that moment, and a custom of jumping over the broomstick as part of that ceremony. Marriage must have always joyous, but also a moment where the fragility of relationships and control over one's fate must come into very clear focus in that circumstance.
Well, it clearly was at that time and under slavery. As you read the narratives, you can hear in the rare instances where the two slaves were actually allowed to cohabit, to live in the same cabin for extended periods of time. Other married couples, so-called married couples, the male slave might live on one plantation, the female slave on another plantation. And there was one particular narrative where they lived on two different plantations, and the person recounting the tale says that despite this, we lived happily and had 11 children. So I guess you're just given many different sides of the fragile home structure, the total, I guess, sense of enslavement, in that every aspect of the lives were sometimes so brutally controlled. Another one of the, I think, one of the more potent stories in the narratives is that of one poor woman who submits to her master's wish to live with a man who she found extraordinarily objectionable, entirely against her will. But
this is another slave she did not want to live with.
Precisely, but the specter of punishment was even greater than really her distaste for this particular man.
How widespread, Ira Berlin, was marriage in the slave population?
Well, of course, marriage doesn't have any legal support. There is no, by law, there is no slave marriage. Of course, masters could divide slaves whenever they wished, selling husbands away from wives, selling children away from parents. Of course, slaveholders could interfere, and of course did interfere in a variety of brutal unacceptable ways enslaved families.
Ira Berlin, hold the thought. We have to take a short break. We're listening tonight to the voices of American slaves. What have we inherited from centuries of slavery? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're listening tonight to the voices of American slaves, their own words, their own voices. My guests are Jacqueline Glover, joining us from New York tonight. She's a producer of the HBO documentary Unchained Memories, Readings from the Slave Narratives. And from Cincinnati, Ohio, Dr. Cynthia Goodman, a guest curator for the Unchained Memories exhibition organized for the Underground Railroad Freedom Center. And from College Park, Maryland, Ira Berlin, editor of Remembering Slavery, African Americans Talk About Their Personal Experiences of Slavery and Emancipation. He's professor of history at the University of Maryland and chief advisor of the Unchained Memories documentary. You can join the conversation as well. What do we hear when American slaves tell their own stories? And what strikes you in the tone and attitude of one-time American slaves? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Allison's calling. Hi, Allison. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, first of all, I'd just like to congratulate everybody who worked on this project for making this history much more real for us in the modern day. Mm. And I guess what I hear is a lot of surviving. And I wanted to ask the speakers and your guests about the survivors of slavery, the current survivors of slavery, and the
You mean survivors or descendants,
well,
Allison?
Yes, the sort of the descendants, mm-hmm, the mm-hmm. multi-generational survival that's
right.
going on.
Got it.
And the debate that we have now about reparations and what these stories say about that debate, if anything, what people who have responded to this this program have said about how it can inform reparations.
Allison, it's a hot question and a good one. Jacqueline Glover, you're the producer. Mm-hmm. Let me put it to you.
Yeah.
You produced the show. You've been bathed in all these voices and memories. You're an African-American woman. How does it, how do these insights inform your own thinking about reparations? And do you see wider repercussions on the debate?
Right. It certainly brings it to, today, we get to hear what it is the slaves did. Mm-hmm. And I think by hearing these narratives, reading these narratives, you have an understanding that you might not have had before as to how over 250 years of free labor, this country mm-hmm. was built mm-hmm. and truly made this country what it is, I believe, as far as its wealth.
Cotton was the number one export.
That's right. So,
but did it leave you thinking this is history or this is a debt unpaid?
Well, for me, as a descendant of slaves, mm-hmm. I don't feel it's entirely history. I think mm-hmm. that, from the point of slavery to, up until today, that slavery certainly is the root of slavery and the racism that went with that is the root of still many problems that exist in this country today.
So reparations, should they be made?
For me, it's a hard question to answer because mm-hmm. I think it's a very complicated question. I feel that certainly the first thing to do is to recognize and to acknowledge the contribution that African Americans who were slaves in this country contributed to this country. And mm-hmm. I think and then once slavery was ended, to understand and acknowledge all the hardships that came after slavery, Jim Crow, segregation in the South, and it just the difficulties starting from slavery and then moving forward, certainly there was a price that was paid for and still being paid for the past. Mm-hmm. So, I think that that's the first step is to acknowledge that this certainly is an issue and and should be addressed.
Cynthia Goodman, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
Well, I was just going to say, it's hard for me to answer about reparations and how it would all work because I don't know how it would all work. I think it's very complicated.
Cynthia Goodman, may I put the same question to you? How do these voices leave you thinking about reparations? Acknowledgement, real, true, honest acknowledgement is some kind of justice, but is it sufficient? Are you left with a view on reparations?
I must say, I must agree with Jacqueline that the actual, implementation of something like reparations is sort of mind-boggling how it would actually take place. Mm-hmm. Certainly, though, hearing these words, being confronted with the photographs, reading the archives at length, as all of us involved in this project have been, the suffering and the anguish and the horrors are undeniable.
Joy's calling from Pleasantville, Pennsylvania. Hi, Joy. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. Good evening. Joy, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
I just got finished reading the book Roots for school, and I really understand what these slaves are going through.
How old are you, Joy?
I'm 15.
And what picture came up to you from Roots? Does it jibe with what you're hearing in the recordings tonight?
Yes, I read about how they jumped the broom when they were getting married, and mm-hmm. it was like they were like so excited when they were doing that.
Mm-hmm. And you can hear that even now in these tapes. Ira Berlin, what about the Roots legacy? When you hold it up, Joy's 15, she's just read it. It's an eye opener to her. When you hold it up to the actual voices of the slaves, does it stand up as a true account?
Well, I think what we're hearing in Unchained Memories and Remembering Slavery, and then going back really to Roots, which in some sense is a path-breaking television docudrama in that it really, for the first time, brings the question of slavery to a modern mass audience. I think
20, 25 years ago
now. All of these things is people trying to grapple with the institution of slavery. Mm-hmm. We see it in our politics. We see it in our popular culture. We see it in our movies and now TV shows and monuments, museums such as the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati. What exactly does it mean? And I think they bespeak this attempt to grapple with the central institution of our past. For most of American history, we are a slave society.
Joy, thanks for calling, and you keep reading. Bob's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
You know, I must say that I think this is embellishment of the connotation of what do you think the slave meant by this is really a lot of scientific cotton candy and fluff. I think there's no veracity to this.
To the tapes, Bob?
I doubt the veracity of tapes to start off with, and I certainly doubt the veracity of this story. They're certainly embellished by these people, and I think we can do nothing except incite insurrection between blacks and whites.
But let me ask first, Bob, are you saying that all oral history is embellished or that there's some special embellishment?
Oral history is very difficult to prove unless you have other people there to substantiate that. I mean, stories are stories, and you have these people saying these things. I'm sure you can get just as many people saying that slavery was good. But listen, if his grandfather lived to be 115 years old, sign me up. I'd like to do that.
Do you think that the country is such a powder keg around Bob, I want to ask you, do you think the country is such a powder keg around race that it can't or shouldn't look back at this history?
Yes, I think at this stage now, no one's not aware of black history. And, of course, all throughout history and all for millennia, there's been slavery. Israel had a lot of slaves. This is nothing new, but we keep bringing this up because the idea—
But the slavery of Israel is in the Bible. We read about it every Sunday.
My point is, but we always talk about slavery in America as if America is this evil Indian killer, slave master, and so forth. And during a time when our country is under attack, I think this is doing a disservice. I think you're insurrecting blacks to move into the Muslim sect and become anti-American. I think it's very dangerous. And there's no scientific veracity. It's just opinion.
Bob, I hear it's upsetting to you, and we acknowledge your voice. Cynthia Goodman, I guess, A, the veracity of the tapes. Is there any doubt about the fact that, or is it indisputably a fact that these were actual recordings of actual former slaves?
Well, I think we are, those of us who study these materials, have one living voice, which I think all of us have had the occasion to speak with. He is a gentleman by the name of Stetson Kennedy, who is the sole living former interviewer. And he's written extensively about his experience as an interviewer and spoken extensively about it. And we discussed specifically the issue of authenticity. And he said, you know, in some ways, we were often criticized because we might be untrained interviewers. These might be people going out in the fields for the first time. And he said, I feel it made our interviews all the more accurate. The interviewers were as folksy as the people they were interviewing.
And Ira Berlin, we've only got a minute left, but our caller Bob says this is inciting racial conflict at a time when we need to be united. Does it do that in your mind, or something else?
I think it's an attempt to understand our past, a serious attempt to understand our past, to deal with it honestly. And I can't help but believe by dealing with our past honestly, with coming to terms with who we are, we become not a weaker people, but a stronger people.
Jacqueline Glover, you're the producer. 30 seconds left. Is this divisive or does this bring us to a shared understanding?
I would have to say that it brings us to a shared understanding. I think that people are, at least I've been getting the feedback, that people are very appreciative that this is that they're finally learning about something that is part of our history, all of us as Americans, and we're learning the details really for the first time. We haven't heard these. They've been at the Library of Congress for 70 years, and they, you know, have just recently been out there for anybody to listen to talk about.
I have to say, I've learned from the tapes, and I thank you for bringing them back out front and center, Jacqueline Glover. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Jacqueline Glover is producer of the HBO documentary Unchained Memories, Readings from the Slave Narratives. And Dr. Cynthia Goodman in Cincinnati, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Ira Berlin in College Park, Maryland, professor of history at the University of Maryland. Thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. You take care.
You too. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. In a moment, the light of hometown support for loved ones deployed to the Middle East. This is On Point. We'll you see a lone electric candle sitting in the window across the street, do not assume your neighbors have been slow to take down their Christmas decorations again this year. Across the country, hundreds of Yuletide candles have returned to windowsills as a symbol of support for loved ones who have been deployed to the Middle East by the U.S. military. It all started 3 weeks ago with 8 lights in Needham, Massachusetts, and it has spread as far as Hawaii. Nancy Wright is leading the effort to display the so-called Chris lights, named in honor of her son. In this radio diary, Wright describes the simple gesture that has given rise to a nationwide movement.
Well, on Friday, January 17th, our son Chris, who is in the U.S. Marine Corps, left aboard the USS Bonhomme Richard with about 10,000 other Marines and naval personnel on their way to the Middle East, as we know, for an indefinite period of time. And the day he left, our neighbors just presented us with something that was wonderful. They gave us a small candle, the type many of us put in our windows, electric candle we put in our windows during the holidays. What made it wonderful was they attached this note, and the note said, "Once a Christmas light, now a Chris light. This candle is given to you by the neighborhood that you have given so much to. We each have a candle just like this one. Starting tonight, we will all put this light in our window and leave it on 24 hours a day until Chris returns. The light it puts out is small, but the message is not. Please let him know that whenever he comes home, day or night, the lights will be on." It was so overwhelming when they gave that to us. Our neighborhood was totally lit up. Each person had one light in their window, and we said, if we feel this way, then there have to be hundreds of thousands of other families just like us who would like to be supported in the same way. So we sent an email to 10 of our friends and neighbors across the country, and it spread like crazy, and everybody thought it was a wonderful idea, and now we have lights in 15 states from Massachusetts to Hawaii, Alaska, Florida, Texas, just to name a few. And that's where it started. The Chris Lights Project is clearly not a political issue. It's totally about all of us supporting all of them. We received an email from a naval officer stationed in Japan. He had received a copy of the email and heard about the Light Project, and he was overwhelmed by the fact that all of us back here in the States are showing support for them in such a small way. And he told his fellow naval personnel what we were doing, and they felt really good about it. And so therein lies the value, but it makes them feel good. The hope is that we won't have our lights on for very long because we want them to be home soon. I don't know how realistic it is, but I think it's just a nice thought that keeps us, everyone, going. And anybody I know who drives past a neighborhood or a street with those lights on feels a sense that maybe they'll be home soon.
Nancy Wright lives in Needham, Massachusetts. Her son Chris is deployed in the Middle East with the U.S. Marine Corps. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.